I'm late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
It's a proud day for America. And by God, we've kicked Vietnam Syndrome once and for all. Thank you very, very much.
I say it again. You've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked.
These witnesses are trying to simply deny things that just about everybody else accepts as fact.
He came, he saw, he died.
But we ain't killing they army, but we killing them. We be on CNN like, say our name, Ben, say it three times.
The meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion.
All right, you guys, introducing Peter Van Buren. Former State Department whistleblower, author of We Meant Well and Hooper's War. And he's got this article running at wementwell.com. We also ran it on antiwar.com and at the Libertarian Institute, too. The offending tweets that got me banned for life from Twitter. Welcome back to the show. How you doing?
Thank you. I'm glad I'm not a band here.
Yeah. Well, you're always welcome. I like talking
that's
with
good.
You.
That's good to know.
So now this is a thing, and it's another opportunity for me to say that I didn't quit because I'm mad that they kicked me off of there for a week for defending you. I actually was a Twitter abuser, and I'm now in recovery, and I'm back to I quit at cold turkey, and I took the opportunity to do so because I needed to, and now I'm back to reading books and actually learning things instead of wasting my life on there. So that's good. But, and I'm sure, in fact, you already told me that you're benefiting from no longer being on Twitter, as well, because it is horrible, but, it wasn't your choice. You got thrown off of there and you got thrown off of there for doing the right thing. It looks like, huh?
So it appears. I seem to have been scooped up in some kind of broader, move by Twitter to purify itself. The same week that Alex Jones got, manipulated on Twitter, and you and Dan McAdams and some other people who speak out against war and in favor of a more democratic society, we all seem to commit offenses sort of more or less simultaneously in what appeared to be a fairly organized purification ritual over a Twitter. In my specific case, I had picked up on a thread that Glenn Greenwald had started, basically saying that while the media may or may not be enemies of the people, in the president's words, they certainly have been cheerleaders for America's wars. And he took them a bit to task for that. And I joined in and suggested that by playing along with what the government always tells us about wars in using words like enhanced interrogation instead of torture, that the media is very much a part of America's war effort. And they basically suck for doing that. This brought forth a tsunami of self-righteousness from a number of media people. It was led by a woman named Salome Anderson. The last name is important there. Her father, for listeners who are not familiar, was Terry Anderson, who worked, I believe, for the Associated Press in the Middle East, was held hostage in the Middle East for 6 years by Hezbollah in Lebanon, and along with some other Americans, and was released under very unclear circumstances, but became kind of a symbol of heroism among journalists. She took offense to what President Trump said, to what Greenwald said, and since neither Trump nor Greenwald respond to her, particularly to what I said, that basically the majority of journalists that I interacted with professionally while I worked for the State Department, for the government, were not inquisitive, were not well-read or educated, and in fact, were very happy to act as stenographers for us, and that as a government official, myself and many of my colleagues held journalists in contempt. They were so easy to fool. It wasn't difficult to cover things up in this elaborate process. It was actually very, very easy. You simply told the journalists whatever lies were the government's line that particular week, and they wrote it down. And they were far more interested in looking good on camera than they were in parsing out a story. She took offense at that. She dragged her dead father into it. Her father, by the way, was in first grade. She was in first grade when her father was in Lebanon. So this is not exactly like it's a fresh wound. You know, she dragged her father into it and said that everyone's being disrespectful to his courage and memory, and decided that I was sexist because I said that many journalists were interested more in how their makeup looked. Now, of course, I quickly responded that my comment was against all journalists, that many of the pretty boys on CNN seem to spend as much more time on their makeup than many of the women journalists I'd run across. And besides the fact that I admitted in front of Twitter and the world, as I had in my book, We Meant Well, and numerous other places, that I lied as a government official. I absolutely positively lied as a government official. I lied to journalists. I lied to people who needed to be lied to, according to the rules in place at that time. And the journalists ate it all up. All of her friends jumped in. I was told she has more courage in her little finger than I have, and that I am a piece of filth, a lousy human being. Lots of bad things were said about my books and about me. And at the end of it all, I was banned from Twitter for life, for dehumanizing people, and for using ridicule or something to silence folks. In fact, it seemed that most of the silencing was directed at me, but in the way things work, Twitter is now a better place. It's now a purer place. There are far less opinions that offend people. The need, the question of whether or not making comments in 2018 about the flaccidity of the press demeans the memories of people who showed courage 40 years ago will be left unchallenged, because luckily, the only people that now have to listen to me are the folks at the street corner who gather occasionally to put nickels in my cup as I offer my opinions there.
Mm-hmm. Who are listening to this show, you mean? Yeah.
Pardon me? Yeah, in addition to this show, where I rarely get nickels.
No, those are the listeners to this show. Yeah.
Oh, I see. I see. No, anyway. Yeah, a lot of them do talk about hearing things.
I heard you on Scott's show and a lot of other stuff, too.
Yeah, a lot of these things fall into place right now, and you could tell them that that nickels don't really get you very far. You gotta move up to quarters if you want to, be able to make a purchase at the end of the day. But nonetheless, yeah, that's what happened. Basically, there's a non-story on Twitter. The best news, though, of all, is that the tweets that I sent that were so offensive that I could not be on Twitter forever and ever and ever are now available to me. Little bird
That's
at Twitter.
What I was going to ask you. Where'd you get him? What's the source here?
Little bird. I don't want to say too much because I don't know how forensics work on these things. I don't want to be the Intercept outing my mini version of Reality Winner here. And so I don't want to say too much about it, but a little bird at Twitter told me what tweets were the ones that pushed me into the blacklist category and helped me reconstruct those tweets. And they're on my blog at wementwell.com. And you can go look for it yourself. I mean, shut off take the headphones off right now and just go look, and you can read everything that happened. Scott, you were there looking over my shoulder metaphorically in real time as this tweet storm unfolded. And have you had a chance to look at the tweets on my blog? Do they appear to be complete? Did I leave anything important out?
Well, I actually missed the thread in the first place that day.
Okay.
I decided I didn't want to go trolling through all the responses on Greenwald's tweet. I saw Greenwald's tweet that morning in response to what Trump said. And then I skipped most of that. But, I can see what's going on here. And as you're saying in the tweets, you say that this is, like a tribal response. All these people just attacking you for daring to attack them without dealing with what you're saying at all. As a government official, I lied. And so did the rest of my colleagues. And as reporters, you guys did exactly what you were supposed to do. Repeat those lies to the American people. You're a bunch of tools. And instead of saying, nuh-uh, that never happened because that wasn't my beat, or, okay, well, maybe that happened one time, but still it's your fault for being the liar or anything. Instead, they just attack you and call you a sleazeball and all this, kind of. And I like the thing about, oh, my God, look, everyone, he said something sexist to me about makeup. And then, you know, I guess I could see how, especially if you're really trying to read that wrong, that you have a basis to read that wrong. But then, like you said, you clarified. Oh, no, yeah. I'm talking about the men, too. Obviously, all of these TV news people on camera have to have, you know, some kind of makeup. And that was sure. what you were saying, that they're all just, you know, that's what Greg Palast always called them, the hairdos on TV. They're not even reporters. They're anchors. They're actors, basically, up there reading lines and portraying things the way that they're supposed to be portrayed. And then
you
explain the reality of that. And they're like, oh, you're such a sleazebag. You were lying. And you're going, yeah, but that was back then. That's what makes me a whistleblower now, is that I'm honest about that. And all I'm doing now is calling you out for your part in it. And so we can see why you got thrown off there. It's just because you hurt their feelings and called them out and made them look bad. It's not because of anything sexist. And as though you could silence someone by saying something sexist. Like if your makeup crack was actually the most male chauvinist pig thing you could think of to say to her. How the hell does that silence her anyway? That doesn't silence her. Now we're just talking like, you know, college freshman PCBS where, oh, this is a microaggression against me, or this is a new definition of harming someone, where somehow it's just baked in that we know somehow that that is silencing someone, even though silencing someone already has a definition. And now we're just going to use those words to mean something entirely different, like you made a lady feel weird or something.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing is how quickly, a couple of things. I mean, one is, and people, again, can read this all themselves on my blog. You don't have to take my word for it. The actual tweets are screenshotted there. But how very quickly people sort of morph into that victim role, where whatever is being done has made them a victim of something. And since I was born this way as a white straight man, that's the easiest one to go to these days, is that I am being sexist, misogynistic. We didn't get into homophobic, but we could have if we had a little more time. You know, basically just say, well, the way you are is what the problem is. And in fact, there was one guy who jumped on there that says, because one of the journalists that I was criticizing was a woman, I hate women. And things like that.
Well, you should have just said, hey, don't you dare assume my gender. How could I be a sexist if I identify as a lesbian? My
picture there. But, you know, the whole point is that the slip into victimhood is so quick and easy these days. But I think the thing that is most disturbing about the thread was how people twisted the idea of whistleblower. To recap, for 25 years, I worked for the federal government. I worked for the State Department. I did what I was told. I was a good employee. I lied when I was told to lie. I did what the government wanted me to do. I kept my personal opinions to myself. I followed the rules. And then during the Iraq War, my conscience struck, and I started telling people the truth about what was going on inside the government, and I've continued to do that today. That's what whistleblowers are. The only person who can tell you what's going on inside the government are people who are there, and that's what I did as a whistleblower. And my story is well known and boring, but I lost my job and all that other terrible stuff happened. The bottom line is that in the midst of this thread, I was transformed into a liar and someone who could not be trusted. In other words, if I lied to the American people as a bureaucrat, why would anyone want to trust me now that I'm saying I'm not lying? Or the fact that I changed my position from being one who follows the government line to being one who speaks the truth about the government proves that I'm inherently untrustworthy. Someone went as far as to ask who's paying me. When I replied, I'm paid in rubles and blood. They just kind of took this as serious. And the belief was that, well, as a whistleblower, who can trust you anymore? You know, snitches get stitches. Some guy with a handle like, you know, veteran with a big pickup truck wrote in and said he thinks I should refund my salary because obviously I didn't do a good job and things like that. And, you know, in the age where we are, where everything gets twisted, I found myself personally twisted from someone I wasn't into something that I was into something that I wasn't. And of course, none of the journalists would pick that up and defend me. In fact, one of the journalists in the thread who was helping insult me actually had consulted me several times during the Iraq War after the Iraq War as a truth-telling source. She had reported from the war, and after I came out as a whistleblower, contacted me a number of times to ask me questions, both about historical events, which I filled in blanks for her, and about current events where I tried to offer insight. So the fact that she had previously used me as a source, took advantage of my whistleblowing, and then either, you know, help mock me in this Twitter thread, and then, in fact, wouldn't defend me and defend the concept of whistleblowers, forget about me, and clarify this, all just points to the terrible, terrible state of affairs of 2018, where anything that isn't anti-Trump is assumed to be not only pro-Trump, but pro-Putin, and anyone who is willing to talk about things as objectively as he or she can is an enemy of all that's good and true and right. Journalists always tell the truth, and our saviors and the intelligence community is going to save democracy. It's a goddamn shame that Orwell is right every single point.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
I want to see the guy goof up on something, but in fact, war is peace, love is hate. He just got it all right. It's incredible.
All right, you guys, here's how to support the show. First of all, subscribe to the RSS feeds, iTunes, Stitcher, and all of that. All the feeds are available at scotthorton.org and also at libertarianinstitute.org. You can also follow me on youtube.com/ScottHortonShow and sign up for Patreon. If you do, anybody who signs up for $1 per interview gets 2 free books from Listen and Think Audio. And also, you'll get keys to the new Reddit page, reddit.com/ScottHortonShow. And then if you go to scotthorton.org/donate, $20 will get you the audiobook of Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. $50 will get you a signed copy of the paperback there. And a $100 donation will get you either a QR code, commodity disc, or a lifetime subscription to Listen and Think Libertarian audiobooks. That's all at scotthorton.org/donate. And also anybody donating $5 or more per month there, if you already are or if you sign up now, you'll get keys to that new Reddit group as well. Already got about 50 people in there and it's turning out pretty good. Again, that's reddit.com/ScottHortonShow. If you're already donating or you're a new donor, just email me scott@scotthorton.org and I'll get you the keys there. And hey, do me a favor, give me a good review on iTunes or Stitcher, or if you liked the book on Amazon.com, and the audiobook is also on iTunes, and I sure would appreciate that. And listen, if you want to submit articles to the Libertarian Institute, please do, and they don't have to be about foreign policy. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. Yeah, well, and I like how just twisted and perverse it all is, right? Where John blood-soaked McCain gets to have the last word that we're a nation of ideals, not blood and soil. Yeah, thanks a lot coming from you, right? That's all I need is, you know, the Washington Post and the New York Times, who are absolutely as guilty as McCain in every way for all of the horrible things he did that they provided the cover for. And then they get to say, you know, how dare you attack the media as though any attack on the media is a stand for the state and the current president right. that they hate against them when, no, they're really bad. And as we all know, especially CNN, but the rest of them too, they're cheating for Hillary Clinton is what gave us Donald Trump in the first place that they're so upset about. The Pied Piper strategy. Hey, all our liberal friends in the media, help promote Trump. He'll be the easiest to beat. That's how it got like this in the first place. We know because the Russians supposedly leaked the very true and legitimate and valid emails from her campaign calling for just that.
Well, I had an interesting experience, and I've got an article in preparation right now, hopefully for the American Conservative. I was in the hospital the last week or so. I'm better now. Thank you for all your well wishes. And all of you who have been wishing, you know, my death, sorry, swing and a miss again. But nonetheless, in the hospital, thanks to poor planning and poor Wi-Fi and a fairly robust menu of painkillers. I really, for a week, had little to do but lay on my back and watch mainstream TV news.
Man.
It was quite an experience. It was something I don't watch that stuff. And if I ever do watch CNN or MSNBC, it's usually just a clip, or I'm curious how they handle a particular story, or something like that. But I've never actually sat down and spent time with it. And I did. I probably watched 100 hours of TV for periods of time. I couldn't change the channel, and so I was forced to watch a story evolve over the course of a day on say CNN, where it starts in the morning with the blonde robo anchors who sort of report semi-factually that the Washington Post is covering a story about X, Y, and Z. And by the time it kind of finally goes down the drain at 10 o'clock with, you know, Anderson Cooper and Wolf and Don Lemon and Chris Cuomo, you know, it has morphed into another, you know, gut shot against democracy. And there's a group of people who are screaming that this amendment is in trouble, or the country is falling, or civil war is there. I mean, it's just amazing, this process that unfolds over the course of the day, and how, as hard as you try to parse in your mind what they're saying in terms of what is sort of a fact and what is reported to and sourced by and stated on, it all becomes this blur. And it may have been the painkillers. I leave that open, but it becomes impossible in your mind to sort of think about what you're being told. It's too hard. It's so much easier to just let the little yellow pills find their way to the forefront and start accepting that assertions are facts and sources are facts. And it's all very true what's going on. And that, you know, in the back of my mind, I know that John McCain voted with Trump over 90% of the time. I know that he has low ratings from most veterans groups because he doesn't support the troops. I know that he has argued for more war than the United States has been able to satisfy him with over decades. And yet, at the same time, I'm being told consistently that he's not any of those things at all, that he's a maverick and the voice of responsibility in the Republican Party and a peacemaker and a diplomat. And eventually you just can't square those two, and it becomes easier to, like I said, lay back and let the yellow pill do its job.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and it must be Kimberly Dozier that you're talking about, who used to cite you and then joined in the attacks, because she's the only lady reporter in this thread that I see. So,
yeah, you know, who knows? Yeah. But the idea.
Well, she says, hey, you're attacking my tribe. And she's talking about reporters, that you're not allowed to talk bad about us. And yet, I mean, this is the perfect example. What you're talking about is the deification of John McCain, who's the worst person, you know, other than Hillary Clinton, in the whole world. And he's their single favorite politician of all. And, you know, they, you know, it's like, remember the Onion had a thing about how they were almost done building the pyramid for Ronald Reagan when he died, where it just got so out of control for just 2.5 weeks or whatever it is. And, you know, I actually had originally missed, while it was happening, because I quit Twitter, about the whole the controversy over Trump ordering him to put the flag back up to full mast because he didn't want to participate in all of this. And then they made him take it back down to half mast again.
Well, see, that's an interesting example, because I was flat on my back sort of watching some of that unfold in real time as the media presented it. And you very quickly lost track of where the flag was, and it started to not matter anymore, because the flag morphed very, very quickly into a discussion, a symbol, and finally an assertion that Trump doesn't respect people who disagree with him. And it's, wait, is the flag at half mast or is it at full mast now? Or what is it? And, you know, somebody said it, you don't have to fly it more than 48 hours, but that doesn't matter because what happens here, and then the video all kind of got blurred together and you didn't know if you were looking at the old flag or the current flag or the new flag. And at some point, it just became easier to assume that, yes, we were disrespecting John McCain. But McCain was, and they're dragging this one out. I mean, this guy is going to be dead for a long time as far as the media is concerned. I mean, there's plans to have multiple funerals for him. I'm not sure if you saw the New York Times today, which explained that McCain and his staff planned out his multiple funerals prior to his own death.
Remember when he said, "I'll follow Osama bin Laden to the gates of hell."
And Osama is standing there with his arms open saying, "Johnny,
good job. Thanks for getting rid of Saddam and Saleh and Gaddafi and almost Assad for me. Good try there."
It's a solid one down here, buddy. And the thing is that McCain had planned this all out. He left multiple letters and press releases to be sent out after his death. He's got this all planned. He had established who were going to be his pallbearers months ago. You know, the media is just picking up on this. But the good news, of course, is that McCain's death pushed last week's hero of the resistance aside, which was John Brennan. For those of you who can remember more than a few days ago, John Brennan was the media star because of his stand for the First Amendment, which had something to do with Trump taking away his security clearance. None of that made any sense. But Brennan was pushed out in front of all the talk shows. And there he was with Jake Tapper. And there he was on Sunday mornings, you know, his mouth looking like a gas station glory hole, talking about the First Amendment and freedom, when this is a guy who supported torture, supported the extrajudicial killings of American citizens, and spied on the Senate to help make it harder for them to release information on the torture program. I mean,
a guy backed Al Qaeda in Syria for 5 years. Why does everyone always leave that out?
You know, it just gets left out. And that's what happens is that when you say that, you find yourself shouting at the TV and the doctors come in and turn the morphine drip up.
I mean, because I'm just saying, you know, the war against Al-Qaeda is really bad. It only makes them more powerful. But the war for Al-Qaeda is really bad, you know?
We won that one.
Yeah, well, Idlib province is still coming up. So the CIA, I guess they have their last chance to get back in there.
Yeah, we'll see this. But it all becomes very hard to follow when you see this. And then, you know, I start to realize that there are people who spend their whole day like this. When I worked in it was fun. When I worked in Japan, one of my Japanese colleagues, her parents were elderly, and they literally did nothing but watch TV all day long. And this was before Twitter and before even as the internet was just starting to cook up. And so you didn't have as much immediate access to instant breaking news as you do today. But we did, because her parents watched TV from dawn till dusk, and they would call her constantly and update her on whatever the news of the day was. And so we kind of had our own little version of Twitter going on, or you know, texted updates or whatever have you. And there are people who do that. They get their opinions from this. They spend all day watching this. It is pumped into their brains, and it just becomes impossible to argue with. And so you stop arguing with it. And the easiest thing is to either turn it off one way or the other, which I guess is better than the alternative, which is to simply to accept it all and create
turn up the morphine drip.
And turn up the morphine drip. And, yeah. and you create a world that acknowledges this, because you block people who are offensive to you on Twitter. Offensive meaning that they're presenting viewpoints that you don't agree with. And then Twitter joins in and does that on behalf of everyone. So that not only Sulame Anderson and Kim Dozer have to say, gee, we don't want to listen to what Peter has to say anymore, Twitter will step in there and do that on behalf of the entire planet.
Right.
So that we don't have to listen to me or anyone else. And with a little careful pruning, you can make sure that all of your world supports what you see on the television and then read in the newspapers or any place else like that. I mean, in that world, in that hospital room, alternative media was as accessible to me as sushi. And it gets harder when all this gets censored, when what you see on
here's the
Facebook
problem with that,
Twitter.
Though.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I've watched a lot of cable TV news, but they've never been able to sell me on the biggest premise underlying it, which is that this is all the most important stuff you need to know today. I can just tell that it's not. You know, they're telling me about whatever the billionaire that owns the basketball team. They're telling me what he's up to. They're telling me about some TV star did a thing. They're telling me about what Donald Trump tweeted and who got upset or, you know, what person used to, you know, is up for the 2 minutes hate for, you know, something they tweeted a few years ago or whatever. But I know that that's not what's important. I already have my own agenda about what's going on and what matters or not. And so that's the part they can never get me with, is that this is really all you need to know. I remember even, you know, when The Daily Show was at its very best, which it was really good there for a time. But still, the very best that they were ever really doing was criticizing TV news. They were never really saying, meanwhile, the truth is, as we know from the new Hirsch piece in The New Yorker, that U.S. is backing John Dalla and blah, 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 and here's why. It never got that good, ever. Even when it was something like The New Yorker magazine or something, even in The Washington Post, that would really, you know, on page 43, blow the lid off of what's really going on in the context of something or another. You know, and in fact, Syria is the greatest example of that, right? Where if you're reading about this at all, then you know that the good guys are best friends with Al-Qaeda and share their tow missiles with them, and that that amounts to really just supporting Al-Qaeda for years and years. But if you watch it on TV, it's the dictator versus the people, and John McCain says we should be doing more to help them. And where, and that's, and you can tell that the TV news people themselves, that's all they know about it, because they only watch TV too. They don't read either. So none of these people really know what they're talking about. You'd have to really read consistently to know that, like, well, wait, the Jabhat al-Nusra, isn't that, that's Al-Qaeda in Iraq, right? Or, you know what I mean? I remember that from 2 weeks ago. It seems relevant in this piece here, you know?
Yeah. The thing is that you're not who they're targeting. I mean, you were obviously, you know, somebody got to you early on, or your mom smoked while she was pregnant with you or something, Scott, because, you know, the fact that, that you're doing this show and you're still talking to me, for example, you know, but you think about the people that don't have those critical thinking skills, and God knows they're not going to develop them in our educational system. And they become very pliant targets for all of this. You know, I just we were talking about breaking news. Just as we were ranting there, I got a little beep on my Facebook page that the Independent in the UK, which used to be a very good newspaper, is headlining a story saying that Trump is the first U.S. president in 130 years not to have a pet dog in the White House, and you know, the article goes on at great length to talk about basically only shitty human beings, you know, don't adopt dogs, and mentioning that the last president who didn't have a dog, William McKinley, according to the article, died of gangrene, and then going through Trump's tweets and finding that he constantly uses expressions like fired like a dog, begging like a dog, or choking like a dog. And he's obviously not a dog related person. And this is all presented in the same breath as supposedly what's going on in Syria, in North Korea, in the economy, and everything else like that.
Russia.
In Russia. It just simply becomes too much. And you really are left, you can't push back anymore. You're left really with either accepting it or trying to find a way to walk away from it. But participating in it becomes a loser's game, and that's kind of where I feel the Twitter ban is I guess in the long run the right thing for me, though I always would prefer to say to hell with you rather than someone saying to hell with me.
Right.
You know, is the idea that it's impossible to participate there anymore. You're not allowed to sort of have an opinion that varies from the accepted line, because you will be attacked. you'll be attacked personally. You'll be attacked for what you represent. The new way is to make you responsible for not agreeing with the party line. If you don't agree with what journalists say, then you are the conspiracy theorist.
Yeah.
And it's your responsibility to demonstrate why.
The Scott Horton Show is brought to you by books, particularly Kesslin Runs, a new dystopian novel about the very near future by the great Charles Featherstone. Kesslin Runs. Also, No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Badakhshani, and The War State by Mike Swanson about the rise of the military-industrial complex in America after World War II. He also gives great investment advice at WallStreetWindow.com. And when you follow his advice, you'll want to get some precious metals, gold and silver and et cetera, from Roberts and Roberts Brokerage, Inc. That's at rrbi.co, rrbi.co. Also, check out Zencash at zencash.com or zensystem.io. It's a great digital currency, but it's also a messaging app and a document transfer app and all kinds of great stuff, too. Learn all about it at zencash.com. And then there's Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom. If you sign up from the link on my page at scotthorton.org, I'll get a little bit of a kickback there. And check this out. Speaking of scotthorton.org, if you'd like expanddesigns.com to build you a new 2018 model website, go to expanddesigns.com/Scott and you'll save $500. Also, don't forget the bumpersticker.com. Stickers for your band or your business at very reasonable prices. High quality stuff there. It used to be my company back when. Thebumpersticker.com. I'm not so sure we were ever getting our bang for the buck out of it. I mean, we can go and look at the different news feeds for whatever the big story of the day, which that's the most valuable thing about Twitter, really. And then as far as the arguing and all that, I'm not so sure, you know, how much good any of that really does. You know, James Corbett quit Twitter, I guess, about a year ago or so from the Corbett Report. Mm. And he wrote a little thing at the time about how, you know, they say you got this many thousand impressions, but what does that really mean? I mean, someone might have been able to see your tweet, but, you know, I know I'd have a real good tweet and get tens of retweets or likes when I supposedly have almost 20,000 followers on there. So, you know, I don't know. It just seems like one of those things where the psychology of it, you know, like you're a rat getting a little reward every time somebody clicks like, and you're like, yay, I got a like, and kind of thing, that you step back a minute and ask yourself what that amounts to and whether it's really worth your time. I mean, I like all the people I'm interacting with on there. It's not personal against them, but the medium is actually really bad. And it's destructive, I think, to critical thought, as you're saying. I mean, it's access to critical opinions if you're looking for them, so that's good. You know, access to disagreement. But at the same time, you know, if watching TV news is idiocy compared to reading an article, and reading an article is nothing compared to reading a book, then what the hell is Twitter? You know, it's a disaster.
The thing that one of the things I have found over the years is with social media is that it bleeds into the writing that I do, and it bleeds into what is asked of me. I've been lucky enough to write for a lot of places. I even was published a couple of times in the New York Times before I became an enemy of the resistance and stuff like that. And what's happened over the years is editors have taken this all to heart, and the length of articles becomes shorter and shorter and shorter. The need to just say it and avoid trying to build an argument. Used to be that you had to sort of prove points, you needed to include links and things. And now a lot of that just kind of, if you say it's true, it's probably good enough for what we're doing here and things like that. And I think it's really had a very bad feedback link loop. You know, the thing though is obviously there's an inherent undercurrent here that I'm not entirely happy about getting kicked off Twitter. And I have to admit to that, because one of the values of it, well, there are two values that I did derive from it. One is that it did put me in touch with people that I otherwise would never have come in contact with. The world's too big a place. And I can't get to Iceland or Australia or Tajikistan, you know, as often as I'd like. And so I was able to link up with people who had things to say that I never would have been. But I think the other, and this is where the danger lies for us in a broad, us in a broader sense, is discoverability. You know, the idea would be that the internet was supposed to free us from the constraints of corporate publishing, that anyone could then could have a website, anyone could put their thoughts online, and it would expose people or allow people to be exposed if they wanted to, a broader range of thoughts. And especially as Google and Twitter and Facebook came to basically dominate the online ecosphere, discoverability through those outlets became very, very important. That's the difference between me standing on the corner yelling at people for nickels and appearing on your show and appearing on Tucker Carlson's show. It's how discoverable those ideas are. I say the same thing in all three platforms, if you will, but they have various degrees of discoverability in them. And Twitter was at one point a fairly small d democratic way to get discovered and for an idea to be discovered. Google used to be much the same. And that's all gone now. And I worry very much about how corporate media and the monopolies that these companies now exercise, how they will continue to exercise that monopoly power in ways that limit the range of ideas that we see and make it harder and harder to discover people.
Yeah.
And that's of concern to me, because that was the big promise of the internet. That was what it was supposed to do for us all. And the idea of saying, well, you don't have to be on Twitter, you can be on XYZ and the new platform and this thing and that. The problem is that you can do all those things and you can go stand on the street corner and yell at strangers. It's right now, the discoverable factor is so important in trying to get your a message out. And if you are barred from that, then Twitter or Facebook or whoever has, in fact, exercised a very, very powerful tool against free speech in the most important terms, not arguing over what does and doesn't apply to the First Amendment, but in fact, more importantly, the concept of a society that has access to a very broad range of ideas and trusts its citizens to sort through that stuff. That's gone away. It's one of those things that, like our privacy post 9/11, the majority of people will only come to recognize it actually happened several years from now, but it has happened. And I think that portion of that version of America, however imperfect, is gone now.
Well, I'm a lot more optimistic about the future of the internet than you. I mean, okay.
Cheer
more
me
and
up.
More, I think, you know, look, Twitter and Facebook are real cul-de-sacs, right? They are. This is what America Online tried to do with the walled garden thing, you know, mm-hmm. like a GeoCities or whatever, kind of things that don't exist anymore, because you know, people prefer a wider, more open internet. And what we liked about Facebook was that it worked. But then, you know, and it's been a little while that they've been screwing with all the algorithms on there, and you know, Twitter's now following suit too, but it pisses everybody off. So you know, I'm not sure what the solution is, or, you know, if it's going to be Mastodon or this, that, or the other kind of thing, but certainly it's going to be something at some point here, because the market demands it and the internet is open enough. I mean, if they really want to go after everybody's ISP and where you just cannot get a server anywhere and this kind of thing, that, you know, there could be a real clampdown coming along those lines. But more or less, if you can have a server and have a website and have your own blog, hell, I say we all go back to the era of the blogs, man. That was great. Back when the antiwar.com blog was going and the stress blog and all that, there was a lot of great stuff.
The thing again is that in a modern world, your blog is only as visible as Google and the other versions of that, or the future versions of that, are willing to make it. You can be there online. It's like in the old days when you could, before pre-internet, you know, you could print off a mimeographed, you could make photocopies of a newspaper. You could have your own newspaper, right? You could type something up and make copies and hand them out or sell them or whatever you want to do. But I mean, your range was always going to be so limited. When you're talking about the internet now, the amount of stuff out there guarantees that very few people will see something unless it's brought to their attention. And given the way that the internet works physically, you know, you have to bring it to the attention of a million people to get whatever, I'm just making numbers up, to get 100,000 to even glance at its existence, to get actually get one person to actually read it. If you've ever done any online advertising, you know, you get all these wonderful statistics. I did a little bit with my books, and you know, you find out that your ad was supposedly shown to this many people on Facebook, and this many people engaged with it, whatever that means, and this many people clicked. And then at the end of the day, you see how those numbers dwindle down to that one sad purchase late Tuesday night. And, you know, you wonder who the hell that guy was. Thanks, but I appreciate it, Scott. I needed the sale.
I'm thinking of my own bars of grass I was looking at this morning. Thanks a lot.
But I mean, it's that idea that, yeah, it's all blogs and goods and stuff like that. But when, you know, somebody has acquired millions of voices on Twitter, and you can't even sort of nudge into the background behind her, your voice is of little impact. And that's a concern. Anyway,
well, you know, we still have antiwar.com. That's a pretty big site.
It is, and it's important, and we will keep doing it. And I think it becomes incumbent upon listeners and readers to push these thoughts if they, you know, if they find them of value, that to push them in front of other people, because at the end of the day, nothing is going to be more effective than word of mouth, an informed friend saying, hey, you know, it's interesting that you think that. There's a lot of other information about it out there. Why don't you take a look at antiwar.com? That's always going to be more effective than 20 bazillion Facebook impressions. Yeah. But at the end of the day, that's what we've got left to us, because the tools of mass communication are being reabsorbed by the corporate body away from us. And so we're left with what we've got, and we need to make the best use of it.
Yep. Yeah, hey, MySpace came and went, and, you know, Facebook and YouTube and these things dominate now, but all that can change very quickly, I think.
Sure.
Assuming the equal access to the internet itself remains open. Yep. It seems the code is there for people to replace these things with something better.
But the paradigm won't change. I mean, the idea that MySpace went away and Facebook grew up, the paradigm didn't change. So the idea that something that XYZ is going to replace Facebook is certain. But the idea that there's going to be a dominant force is also certain. And that paradigm is the worrisome one, not that it's in the hands of Facebook versus XYZ versus something else. And that's where my concern lies, is that reabsorption into the corporate body of control over the channels. We've seen this happen in other media. I mean, way back in time, cable TV was supposed to answer this problem, right? There was supposed to be all this public access cable television. Tell the truth. Did you ever have a public access channel?
Well, in Austin, they have one. I never had a show on there.
You never had a show. All right, fair enough. You're about 8 years behind on that. But I mean, this idea was that cable TV was going to make all this public access available, and everybody was going to be able to have a TV show, and you didn't have to just listen to CBS, NBC, and ABC. And it turned out not to be very effective. It was reabsorbed. It was blown. Those shows were blown away by the fact that they were of such low quality and such they never were advertised or anything like that. And then the internet was going to fix it. There's kind of an a long pattern of these things, and watching what's happened with Twitter and Facebook and this other corporate censorship we're seeing is saddening to me, because it represents the paradigm surviving yet another technological shift.
Yeah.
And the corporate control surviving yet another, should have been another game changer, but in fact turned out to be just a few years of loose Wild West fun.
Hey, maybe you should just get a new name on there and a new email address and go back to it.
You know, I gave that some thought as well. And who knows what will happen? I can't predict my own actions, you know, up past the next round of meds. But, I mean, the idea would be that how long would that last? Twitter.
I mean, it might be fine. I don't know.
Twitter is based now on the Nazi model, where kids rat out their parents for non-state approved behaviors. And so all it takes is someone, and it would happen within the blink of an eye, saying, ooh, this guy's back. He's going to offend people again. He's going to dehumanize them. Look. And even if I, called myself Horton Scott, as a fake name, it would just be a matter of who knows, days, hours, till I dehumanized someone or took away their breath by calling them little piggies or something.
Yeah.
In this case, the paradigm is what it is, and I don't expect to be back on Twitter.
All right. Well, keep writing it. We meant well, and we'll keep republishing it at antiwar.com, too.
Thank you. And roger that, and I'll be back as soon as I get to make enough money on the corner, nickel at a time.
All right. Well, really good luck with that, man.
Thank you. Take care.
Peter Van Buren, you guys, used to be with the State Department, but now he's all right. And you can find him at wementwell.com and at antiwar.com. And those are his books. Well, that's one of his books, not antiwar.com. But We Meant Well, that's his first book. And then he wrote The Ghosts of Tom Joad about the economic crash. And then the latest is Hooper's War, a novel of post-World War II Japan, which I haven't read yet, but I'm going to. Seems like it's probably going to be really good. All right, y'all, thanks. Find me at libertarianinstitute.org, at scotthorton.org, antiwar.com, and reddit.com/ScottHortonShow. Oh, yeah, and read my book, Fool's Errand, Timed and the War in Afghanistan, at foolserrand.us.